"Thank the Lord this isn't spoilt," said Father as we went in. "How I could work in this room." There were stone mullioned windows looking into the courtyard, as well as the ones at the front overlooking the lane. Father said they were Tudor. Later imperial than the gatehouse itself, but much earlier than the house. We went back into the tower and found the steps of the circular stone staircase good enough for us to go up higher. Once we were crawling into the darkness, I wish they hadn't been. Father struck matches, but there was a dreadful black moment each time one burnt out, and the cold, rough stone felt so strange to my hands and bare knees. But when at last we came out on the battlemented top of the tower, it was worth it all. I had never felt so high in my life, and I was so triumphant at having been brave enough to come up. Not that I'd had any choice. Rose had kept butting me from behind. We stood looking down on the lane and over the fields, stretching far on either side. We were so high that we could see how the hedges cut them up into a patchwork pattern. There were a few little woods, and a mile or so to the left a tiny village. We moved round the tower to look across the courtyard garden, and then we all shouted, "There it is!" at the same moment. Beyond the ruined walls on the west side of the courtyard was a small hill, and on top of it was the high tower we had driven so long in search of. It puzzles me now why we hadn't seen it when we first came through the gatehouse passage. Perhaps the overgrown garden obstructed the view. Or perhaps we were too much astonished at seeing the house to look in the opposite direction. Father dived for the staircase. I cried, "Wait, wait!" And he turned and picked me up, letting Rose go ahead, striking the matches. He guessed the bottom of the staircase must come out in the gatehouse passage. But Rose used the last match as we reached the archway onto the walls. So we went back along them to the bathroom and down the nice little front staircase of the house into the hall. Mother was just coming through the front door to look for us, dragging across sleepy Thomas. He never liked to be left alone in the car. Father showed her the tower on the hill. We could see it easily once we knew where to look, and told her to come along. Then dashed across the courtyard garden. She said she couldn't manage it with Thomas. I remember feeling I ought to stay with her, but I didn't. I raced after Father and Rose. We climbed over the ruined walls which bounded the garden and crossed the moat by the shaky bridge at the southwest corner. That brought us to the foot of the hill. But Father told us it was ancient earthworks and not a natural hill. Ever since then we have called it the Mound. The turf was short and smooth, and there were no more ruins. At the top we had to scramble over some ridges which Father said must have been the outer defences. This brought us to a broad, grassy plateau. At the far end was a smaller mound, round in shape and very smooth. And rising from this was the tower, 60 feet tall, black against the last flush of sunset. The entrance was about 15 feet up, at the top of an outside flight of stone steps. Father did his best to force the door, but had no luck. So we didn't see inside the tower that night. We walked all round the little mound, and Father told us it was called a motte, and that the wide grassy plateau was a bailey. He said all this part was much older than the moated castle below. The sunset faded and a wind got up and everything began to look frightening. But Father went on talking most happily and excitedly. Suddenly Rose said, "It's like the tower in the Lancashire Witches, where Mother Demdike lived." She had read bits of that book aloud to me until I got so frightened that Mother stopped her. Just then we heard Mother calling from below. Her voice sounded high and strange, almost despairing. I grabbed Rose's hand and said, "Come on, Mother's frightened." And I told myself I was running to help Mother, but I was really terrified of being near the tower any longer. Father said we had all better go. We climbed the ridges and then Rose and I took hands and ran down the smooth slope, faster and faster, so that I thought we should fall. All the time we were running, I felt extremely frightened, but I enjoyed it. The whole evening was like that. When we got back to the house, Mother was sitting on the front doorstep nursing Thomas, who had fallen asleep again. "Isn't it wonderful?" cried Father. "I'll have it if it takes my last penny." Mother said, "If it's to be my cross, I suppose God will give me the strength to bear it." Father laughed at that, and I felt rather shocked. I don't in the least know if she meant to be funny, but then I realise more and more how vague she has become for me. Even when I remember things she said, I can't recall the sound of her voice. And though I can still see the shape of her that day huddled on the steps, her back view when we were in the car, her brown tweed suit and squashy felt hat, I can't visualise her face at all. When I try to, I just see the photograph I have of her. Rose and I went back to the car with her, but Father wandered round until it was dark. I remember seeing him come out on the castle walls near the gatehouse and marvelling that I had been up there myself. Even in the dusk I could see his gold hair and splendid profile. He was spare in those days, but broad, always a large person. He was so excited that he started to drive back to King's Crypt at a terrific pace. Rose, Thomas and I simply bounced about at the back of the car. Mother said it wasn't safe with the road so narrow, and he slowed down to a snail's pace, which made Rose and me laugh a lot. Mother said, "There's reason in everything, and Thomas ought to be in bed." Thomas suddenly sat up and said, "Dear me, yes, I ought," which made even Mother laugh. The next day, after making inquiries, Father went over to Scopeney Hall. When he got back, he told us that Mr. Cotton wouldn't sell the castle, but had let him have a 40 years lease on it. "And I can do anything I like to the house," he added, "because the old gentleman agrees I couldn't possibly make it any worse." Of course, he made it very much better, whitewashing it, unearthing the drawing-room panelling from beneath 8 coats of wallpaper, pulling out the worst fireplaces, the false ceilings, the partitions in the kitchen. There were many more things he meant to do, particularly as regards comfort. I know Mother wanted some central heating and a machine to make electric light, but he spent so much on antique furniture even before work at the castle began that she persuaded him to cut things down to a minimum. There was always a vague idea that the useful things were to come later, probably when he wrote his next book. It was spring when we moved in. I particularly remember the afternoon we first got the drawing room straight. Everything was so fresh. The flowered chintz curtains, the beautiful shining old furniture, the white panelling. It had had to be painted because it was in such a poor condition. I was fascinated by a great jar of young green beech leaves. I sat on the floor staring at them while Rose played her piece to a water lily on Mother's old grand piano. Suddenly Father came in a very exulting mood to tell us that there was a surprise for us outside the window. He flung the mullioned windows open wide, and there on the moat were 2 swans sailing sedately. We leaned out to feed them with bread, and all the time the spring air blew in and stirred the beech leaves. Then I went into the garden, where the lawns had been cut and the flower beds tidied. There were a lot of early wallflowers which smelt very sweet. Father was arranging his books up in the gatehouse room. He called down, "Isn't this a lovely home for you?" I agreed that it was, and I still think so. But anyone who could enjoy the winter here would find the North Pole stuffy. How strange memory is. When I close my eyes, I see 3 different castles. One in the sunset light of that first evening, one all fresh and clean as in our early days here, one as it is now. The last picture is very sad because all our good furniture is gone. The dining room hasn't so much as a carpet. Not that we have missed that room much. It was the first one we saw that night. We explored the house, and it was always too far from the kitchen. The drawing room has a few chairs still, and, thank goodness, no one will ever buy the piano because it is so big and old. But the pretty chintz curtains are faded, and everything has a neglected look. When the spring comes, we must really try to freshen up our home a little. At least we can still have beech leaves. We have been poor for 5 years now. After Mother died, I fear we lived on the capital of the money she left. Not that I ever worried about such things at the time, because I always felt sure Father would make money again sooner or later. Mother brought us up to believe that he was a genius and that geniuses mustn't be hurried. What is the matter with him? And what does he do all the time? I wrote yesterday that he does nothing but read detective novels. But that was just a silly generalisation, because Miss Marcy can seldom let him have more than 2 a week, although he will read the same ones again and again after a certain lapse of time, which seems to me amazing. Of course he reads other books too. All our valuable ones have been sold, and how I have missed them. But there are a good many of the others left, including an old, incomplete Encyclopaedia Britannica. I know he reads that. He plays some kind of a game, following up cross-references in it. And I am sure he thinks very hard. Several times when he hasn't answered my knock on the gatehouse room door, I have gone in and found him staring into space. In the good weather, he walks a lot, but he hasn't now for months. He has dropped all his London friends. The only friend he's ever made down here is the vicar, who's the nicest man imaginable. A bachelor, with an elderly housekeeper. Now I come to think of it, Father has dodged seeing even him this winter. Father's unsociability has made it hard for any of us to get to know people here, and there aren't many to know. The village is tiny. Just the church, the vicarage, the little school, the inn, one shop, which is also the post office, and a huddle of cottages. Though the vicar gets quite a congregation from the surrounding hamlets and farms. It is a very pretty village, and has the unlikely name of God's End. A corruption of Goddess End, after the Norman knight, Etienne de Goddess, who built Belmont Castle. Our castle, I mean the moated one, onto which our house is built, is called God's End too. It was built by a later de Goddess. No one really knows the origin of the name Belmont. The whole mound, as well as the tower on it, is called that. At a guess, one would say the bell is from the French. But the vicar believes in a theory that it is from Bel, the sun god, whose worship was introduced by the Phoenicians, and that the mound was raised so that Midsummer Eve votive fires could be lit there. He thinks the Normans simply made use of it. Father doesn't believe in the god Bel theory, and says the Phoenicians worship the stars, not the sun. Anyway, the mound is a very good place to worship both sun and stars from. I do a little worshipping there myself when I get time. I meant to copy an essay on castles I wrote for the School History Society into this journal, but I find it is very long and horridly overwritten. How the school must have suffered. So I shall paraphrase it briefly. Castles. In early Norman times, there seem to have been mounds with ditches and wooden stockades as defences. Inside the defences were wooden buildings, and sometimes there was a high earthen motte to serve as a lookout place. The later Normans began building great square stone towers, called keeps. But it was found possible to mine the corners of these. Mining was just digging then, of course, not the use of explosives. So they took to building round towers, of which Belmont is one. Later, the tower keeps were surrounded with high walls, called curtain walls. These were often built in quadrangle form with jutting towers at the gatehouse, the corners, and in the middle of each side, so that the defenders could see any besiegers who were trying to mine or scale the walls and fight them off. But the besiegers had plenty of other good tricks, notably a weapon called a trebuchet, which could sling great rocks, or a dead horse, over your curtain walls, causing much embarrassment. Eventually, someone thought of putting moats round curtain walls. Of course, the moated castles had to be on level ground. Belmont, Tower Keep, up on its mound, must have been very much of a back number when God's End Castle was built. And then all castles gradually became back numbers, and Cromwell's roundheads battered 2.5 sides of our curtain walls down. Long before that, the de Goddess name had died out, and the two castles had passed to the Cottons of Scotney, through a daughter. The house built on the ruins was their dower house for a time. Then it became just a farmhouse. And now it isn't even that. Merely the home of the ruined Mortmains. Oh, what are we to do for money? Surely there is enough intelligence among us to earn some. Or marry some. Rose, that is. For I would approach matrimony as cheerfully as I would the tomb, and I cannot feel that I should give satisfaction. But how is Rose to meet anyone? We used to go to London every year to stay with Father's aunt, who has a house in Chelsea with a lily pond and collects artists. Father met Topaz there. Aunt Millicent never forgave him for marrying her, so now we don't get asked any more. This is bitter, because it means we meet no men at all, not even artists. Oh me. I am feeling low in spirits. While I have been writing, I have lived in the past. The light of it has been all around me. First the golden light of autumn, then the silver light of spring, and then the strange light, grey but exciting, in which I see the historic past. But now I have come back to earth, and rain is beating on the attic window. An icy draught is blowing up the staircase, and Ab has gone downstairs and left my stomach cold. Heavens, how it is coming down. The rain is like a diagonal veil across Belmont. Rain or shine, Belmont always looks lovely. I wish it were Midsummer Eve and I were lighting my votive fire on the mound. There is a bubbling noise in the cistern which means that Stephen is pumping. Oh, joyous thought! Tonight is my bath night. And if Stephen is in, it must be tea time. I shall go down and be very kind to everyone. Noble deeds and hot baths are the best cures for depression. Chapter 4. Little did I think what the evening was to bring. Something has actually happened to us. My imagination longs to dash ahead and plan developments, but I have noticed that when things happen in one's imaginings, they never happen in one's life, so I am curbing myself. Instead of indulging in riotous hopes, I shall describe the evening from the beginning, quietly gloating, for now every moment seems exciting because of what came later. I have sought refuge in our barn. As a result of what happened last night, Rose and Topaz are spring-cleaning the drawing-room. They are being wonderfully blithe. When I dwindled away from them, Rose was singing The Isle of Capri, very high, and Topaz was singing Blow the Man Down, very low. The morning is blithe too, warmer, with the sun shining, though the countryside is still half-drowned. The barn, we rent it to Mr. Stebbins, but we owe him so much for milk and butter that he no longer pays, is piled high with loose chaff, and I have climbed up on it and opened the square door near the roof so that I can see out. I look across stubble and ploughed fields and drenched winter wheat to the village, where the smoke from the chimneys is going straight up in the still air. Everything is pale gold and washed clean and hopeful. When I came down from the attic yesterday, I found that Rose and Topaz had dyed everything they could lay hands on, including the dishcloth and the roller towel. Once I had dipped my handkerchief into the big tin bath of green dye, I got fascinated too. It really makes one feel rather godlike to turn things a different colour. I did both my nightgowns, and then we all did Topaz's sheets, which was such an undertaking that it exhausted our lust. Father came down for tea, and was not too pleased that Topaz had dyed his yellow cardigan. It is now the colour of very old moss, and he thought our arms being green up to the elbows was revolting. We had real butter for tea because Mr. Stebbins gave Stephen some when he went over to fix about working. He started at the farm this morning, and Mrs. Stebbins had sent a comb of honey. Stephen put them down in my place, so I felt like a hostess. I shouldn't think even millionaires could eat anything nicer than new bread and real butter and honey for tea. I have rarely heard such rain as there was during the meal. I am never happy when the elements go to extremes. I don't think I'm frightened, but I imagine the poor countryside being battered until I end by feeling battered myself. Rose is just the opposite. It is as if she is egging the weather on, wanting louder claps of thunder and positively encouraging forked lightning. She went to the door while it was raining and reported that the garden was completely flooded. "The lane'll be like a river," she remarked with satisfaction, not being a girl to remember that Thomas would have to ride his bicycle down it within an hour. He was staying late at school for a lecture. Father said, "Let me add to your simple pleasure in nature's violence by reminding you that there will shortly be at least 6 glorious new leaks in our roof." There was one in the kitchen already. Stephen put a bucket under it. I told him the 2 attic leaks had started before I came down, but there were buckets under them. He went to see if they were overflowing and returned to say that there were 4 more leaks. We had run out of buckets, so he collected 3 saucepans and the soup tureen. "Maybe I'd best stay up there and empty them as they fill," he said. He took a book and some candle ends, and I thought how gloomy it would be for him reading poetry in the middle of 6 trips. We washed the tea things. Then Rose and Topaz went to the washhouse to shake out the dyed sheets. Father stayed by the fire, waiting for the rain to stop before going back to the gatehouse. He sat very still, just staring in front of him. It struck me how completely out of touch with him I am. I went over and sat on the fender and talked about the weather, and then I realized that I was making conversation as if to a stranger. It depressed me so much that I couldn't think of anything more to say. After a few minutes' silence, he said, "So, Stephen got work at Four Stones?" I just nodded, and he looked at me rather queerly and asked if I liked Stephen. I said that of course I did, though the poems were embarrassing. "You should tell him you know he copies them," said Father. "You'll know how to do it. Encourage him to write something of his own, however bad it is. And be very matter-of-fact with him, my child, even a bit on the brisk side." "But I don't think he'd like that," I said. "I think he'd take briskness for snobbing. And you know how fond of me he's always been."
"Hence the need for a little briskness," said Father.
"Unless, of course, he's a godlike youth. I'm rather glad he's not devoted to Rose." I must have been looking very much puzzled. He smiled and went on.
"Oh, don't bother your head about it. You've so much common sense, you'll probably do the right thing instinctively. It's no use telling Topaz to advise you, because she'd think it all very splendid and natural, and for all I know it might be. God knows what's to become of you girls."
I suddenly knew what he was talking about. "I understand," I said, "and I'll be brisk, within reason. But I wonder if I shall ever manage it. And I wonder if it is really necessary. Surely Stephen's devotion isn't anything serious or grown up. But now that the idea has been put into my head, I keep remembering how queer his voice sounded when he asked me about being hungry. It is worrying, but rather exciting. I shall stop thinking about it. Such things are not in my line at all. They are very much in Rose's line, and I know just what Father meant when he said he was glad Stephen wasn't devoted to her." Topaz came from the washhouse and set irons to heat, so Father changed the subject by asking me if I'd dyed all my clothes green. I said I had few to dye.
"Any long dresses at all?" he asked.
"Nary a one," I replied. "And indeed I cannot see the slightest chance of ever acquiring grown-up clothes. But my school gym dress has a lot of life in it yet, and it's very comfortable." "I must alter something of mine for her," said Topaz, as she went back to the washhouse. I felt my lack of clothes was a reflection on Father, and, in an effort to talk of something else, said the most tactless thing possible. "How's the work?" I asked. A closed-up look came over his face, and he said shortly,
"You're too old to believe in fairy tales."
I knew I'd put my foot in it, and thought I might as well go a bit further. "Honestly, Father, aren't you trying to write at all?"
"My dear Cassandra," he said in a cutting voice he very seldom uses, "it's time this legend that I am a writer ceased. You won't get any coming-out dresses from my earnings."
He got up without another word and went upstairs. I could have kicked myself for wrecking the first talk we'd had for months. Thomas came in just then, wet through. I warned him not to use Father's bedroom as a passage, as we usually do, and he went up the front way. I took him some dry underclothes, fortunately the week's ironing was done, and then went up to see how Stephen was getting on. He had stuck the candle ends on the floor, close to his open book, and was reading lying on his stomach. His face was dazzlingly bright in the great, dark attic. I stood a moment watching his lips moving before he heard me. The saucepans were on the point of overflowing. As I helped him to empty them out of the window, I saw that the lamp was lit in the gatehouse. So Father must have gone back there through the rain. It was slackening off at last. The air smelt very fresh. I leaned out over the garden and found it was much warmer than indoors. It always takes our house a while to realize a change in the weather.
"It'll be spring for you soon, Miss Cassandra," said Stephen.
We stood sniffing the air. "There's quite a bit of softness in it, isn't there?" I said. "I shall think of this as spring rain. Or am I cheating?
You know I always try to begin the spring too soon. He leaned out and took a deep sniff.
It's beginning all right, Miss Cassandra, he said. Maybe we'll get some setbacks, but it's beginning.
He suddenly smiled, not at me, but looking straight in front of him, and added,
Well, beginnings are good times.
Then he closed the windows, and we put the saucepans back under the drips, which played a little ringing tune now that the saucepans were empty. The candle ends on the floor cast the strangest shadows and made him seem enormously tall. I remembered what Father had said about his being a godlike youth. And then I remembered that I had not remembered to be brisk. We went back to the kitchen, and I got Thomas some food. Topaz was ironing her silk tea gown, which looked wonderful. It had been a faded blue, but had dyed a queer sea-green colour. I think the sight of it made Rose extra gloomy. She was starting to iron a cotton frock that hadn't dyed any too well. "Oh, what's the use of messing about with summer clothes anyway?" she said. "I can't imagine it ever being warm again."
There's quite a bit of spring in the air tonight, I told her. You go out and smell it.
Rose never gets emotional about the seasons, so she took no notice. But Topaz went to the door at once and flung it open. Then she threw her head back, opened her arms wide and took a giant breath.
It's only a whiff of spring, not whole lungs full, I said. But she was too rapt to listen.
I quite expected her to plunge into the night, but after some more deep breathing she went upstairs to try on her tea gown.
"It beats me," said Rose. "After all this time I still don't know if she goes on that way because she really feels like it, if she's acting to impress us, or just acting to impress herself."
"All three," I said. "And as it helps her to enjoy life, I don't blame her." Rose went to close the door and stood there a minute, but the night air didn't cheer her up at all. She slammed the door and said, "If I knew anything desperate to do, I'd do it."
"What's specially the matter with you, Rose?" asked Thomas. "You've been beating your breast for days, and it's very boring. We can at least get a laugh out of Topaz, but you're just monotonously grim."
"Don't talk with your mouth full," said Rose. "I feel grim. I haven't any clothes. I haven't any prospects. I live in a mouldering ruin, and I've nothing to look forward to but old age."
"Well, that's been the outlook for years," said Thomas. "Why has it suddenly got you down?"
"It's the long, cold winter," I suggested.
"It's the long, cold winter of my life," said Rose,
at which Thomas laughed so much that he choked. Rose had the sense to laugh a little herself. She came and sat on the table, looking a bit less glowering.
"Stephen," she said, "you go to church. Do they still believe in the devil there?"
"Some do," said Stephen. "Though I wouldn't say the vicar did."
"The devil's out of fashion," I said.
"Then he might be flattered if I believed in him and work extra hard for me. I'll sell him my soul like Faust did."
"Faust sold his soul to get his youth back," said Thomas.
"Then I'll sell mine to live my youth while I've still got it," said Rose.
"Will he hear me if I shout, or do I have to find a devil's dyke or a devil's well or something?"
"You could try wishing on our gargoyle," I suggested. Although she was so desperate, she was, well, more playful than I'd seen her for a long time, and I wanted to encourage her.
"Get me the ladder, Stephen," she said.
What we call our gargoyle is really just a carved stone head high above the kitchen fireplace. Father thinks the castle chapel was up there because there are some bits of fluted stonework and a niche that might have been for holy water. The old wall has been whitewashed so often that the outlines are blurred now.
"The ladder wouldn't reach, Miss Rose," said Stephen. "And the vicar says that's the head of an angel."
"Well, it's got a devilish expression now," said Rose. "And the devil was a fallen angel." We all stared up at the head, and it did look a bit devilish. Its curls had been broken, and the bits that were left were like horns.
"Perhaps it would be extra potent if you wished on an angel and thought of the devil," I suggested.
"Like witches saying mass backwards."
"We could haul you up on the drying rack, Rose," said Thomas.
The rack was pulled up high with the dyed sheets on it. Rose told Stephen to let it down, but he looked at me to see if I wanted him to. She frowned and went to the pulley herself. I said, "If you must fool about with it, let me get the sheets off first." So she lowered them, and Stephen helped me to drape them over two clothes horses. Thomas held the rope while she sat on the middle of the rack and tested its strength. The rack'll bear you, said Stephen. I helped make it, and it's very strong. I don't know about the rope and pulleys. I went and sat beside her, feeling that if the weight of both of us didn't break anything, it would be safe for her alone. I knew from the look in her eye and her deep flush that it wasn't any use trying to dissuade her. We bounced about a bit, and then she said, "Good enough. Pull me up." Stephen went to help Thomas. "But not you, Miss Cassandra," he said. "It's dangerous." "I suppose you don't mind me breaking my neck," said Rose. "Well, I'd rather you didn't," said Stephen. "But I know you wouldn't stop for the asking. Anyway, it's you who want to wish on the angel, not Miss Cassandra." I'd have been glad to wish on anything, but I wouldn't have gone up there for a pension. "It's a devil, not an angel, I tell you," said Rose. She sat swinging her legs a minute, then looked round at us all. "Does anyone dare me?" "No," we all shouted, which must have been very irritating. She said, "Then I dare myself. Haul me up." Thomas and Stephen hauled. When she was about 10 feet from the floor, I asked them to stop a minute. "How does it feel, Rose?" I said. "Peculiar, but a nice change. Go on, boys." They pulled again. The carved head must be over 20 feet up, and as she rose higher and higher, I had an awful feeling in my stomach. I don't think I had realized until then how very dangerous it was. When she was within a few feet of the head, Stephen called up, "That's as high as the rack'll go." She reached up but couldn't touch the head. Then she called down, "There's a foothold here. It looks as if there were steps once." The next second, she had leaned forward, grasped a projecting stone and stepped onto the wall. The lamp on the table didn't throw much light up there, but it looked terribly dangerous to me. "Hurry up and get it over," I called. The backs of my legs, as well as my stomach, were most uncomfortable. She only had to take one step up the wall to reach the head. "He's no beauty at close quarters," she said. "What shall I say to him, Cassandra?" "Pat him on the head," I suggested. "It must be hundreds of years since anyone showed him any affection." Rose patted him. I got the lamp and held it high, but it was still shadowy up there. She looked extraordinary, almost as if she were flying up the wall or had been painted on it. I called out, "Heavenly devil or devilish saint, grant our wish, hear our plaint. God's End Castle, a godsend craves." And then I got stuck.
"If he's a devil, it can only be a devil send," said Thomas.
Just then, a car on the Godsend Road hooted loudly, and he added,
"There's old Nick come for you."
I saw Rose start. "Get me down," she cried in a queer voice and flopped onto the rack. For one awful second I feared the boys might not be expecting the strain, but they were ready and lowered her carefully. As soon as her feet were near the ground, she jumped off and sat down on the floor. "The car horn startled me," she said rather shakily. And I looked down and went giddy. I asked her to describe her exact feelings up there, but she said she hadn't had any until she turned giddy. That is one great difference between us. I would have had any number of feelings and have wanted to remember them all. She would just be thinking of wishing on the stone head.
"You never did wish, did you?" I asked. She laughed.
"Oh, I said a few private things, all right."
Topaz came downstairs just then, in her black oilskin, sou'wester hat and rubber boots, looking as if she were going to man the lifeboat. She said her dyed tea gown had shrunk so much that she couldn't breathe in it, and Rose could have it. Then she strode out, leaving the door wide open.
"Don't swallow the night, will you?" Thomas called after her.
"Your luck started already," I told Rose, as she dashed upstairs to try the tea gown on. Thomas went to do his homework in his room, so I thought I might as well start my bath and ask Stephen if he minded me having it in the kitchen. I generally do have it there, but as it means he has to keep out of the way for a good long time, I always feel apologetic. He tactfully said he had a job to do in the barn and that he would help me get the bath ready. "But it's still full of dye," I remembered. We emptied it, and Stephen swirled it out.
"But I'm afraid the dye may still come off on you, Miss Cassandra," he said. "Hadn't you better use the bathroom?" The bathroom bath is so enormous that there is never enough hot water for more than a few inches, and a draught blows down the tower. I decided I would rather risk the dye. We carried the bath to the fire, and Stephen baled hot water from the copper and helped me to make a screen of clothes horses with the green sheets on. As a rule, I use dust sheets for this. As our clothes horses are fully 5 feet high, I always have a most respectable and private bath, but I do feel more comfortable if I have the whole kitchen to myself.
"What will you have to read tonight, Miss Cassandra?" asked Stephen. I told him Vol. Bis to Cal of our old encyclopedia, Man and Superman, which I have just reborrowed from the vicar. I feel I may have missed some of the finer points when I first read it 5 years ago, and last week's Home Chat, kindly lent by Miss Marcy. I like plenty of choice in my bath. Stephen set them all out for me while I collected my washing things, and then, after he had lit his lantern to go to the barn, he suddenly presented me with a whole tuppenny bar of nut milk chocolate. "How did you come by that?" I gasped. He explained that he'd got it on credit, on the strength of having a job. "I know you like to eat in the bath, Miss Cassandra. What with books and chocolate, there's not much else you could have in it, is there? Except perhaps a wireless."
"Well, don't go getting a wireless on credit," I laughed, and then thanked him for the chocolate and offered him some. But he wouldn't take any and went off to the barn. I was just getting into the bath when Heloise whined at the back door and had to be let in. Of course, she wanted to come to the fire, which was a slight bore, as she is no asset to a bath. Her loving paws are apt to scrape one painfully. However, she seemed sleepy, and we settled down amicably. It was wonderfully cosy inside my tall, draught-proof screen, and the rosy glow from the fire turned the green sheets to a fascinating colour. I had the brainwave of sitting on our largest dinner dish to avoid the dye. The gravy runnels were a bit uncomfortable, though. I believe it is customary to get one's washing over first in baths and bask afterwards. Personally, I bask first. I have discovered that the first few minutes are the best and not to be wasted. My brain always sees with ideas and life suddenly looks much better than it did. Father says hot water can be as stimulating as an alcoholic drink, and though I never come by one, unless the medicine bottle of port that the vicar gives me for my midsummer rites counts, I can well believe it. So I bask first, wash second, and then read as long as the hot water holds out. The last stage of a bath, when the water is cooling and there is nothing to look forward to, can be pretty disillusioning. I expect alcohol works much the same way. This time I spent my basking and thinking about the family, and it is a tribute to hot water that I could think about them and still bask. For surely we are a sorry lot. Father, mouldering in the gatehouse. Rose, raging at life. Thomas. Well, he is a cheerful boy, but one cannot but know that he is perpetually underfed. Topaz is certainly the happiest, for she still thinks it's romantic to be married to Father and live in a castle. And her painting, her lute, and her wild communing with nature are a great comfort to her. I would have taken a bet that she had nothing whatever on under her oilskins, and that she intended to stride up the mound and then fling them off. After being an artist's model for so many years, she has no particular interest in nudism for its own sake, but she has a passion for getting into closest contact with the elements. This once caused quite a little embarrassment with Fourstone's farm, so she undertook only to go nude by night. Of course, winter is closed season for nudity. But she is wonderfully impervious to cold, and I felt sure the hint of spring in the air would have fetched her. Though it was warmer, it was still far from warm, and the thought of her up on Belmont made my bath more comfortable than ever. I ate my chocolate and meant to offer the rest to Rose, but Heloise was lashing her tail so hopefully that I shared with her instead. Her gratitude was so intense that I feared she might get into the bath with me. I calmed her, discouraged her from licking the soap, and had just started serious washing when there was a thump on the door. I still can't imagine what made me call out, "Come in." I suppose I said it automatically. I had just covered my face with soap, which always makes one feel rather helpless, and when I rashly opened my eyes, the soap got into them. I was blindly groping for the towel when I heard the door open. Heloise let forth a volley of barks and hurtled towards it. It was a miracle she didn't knock the clothes horses over. The next few seconds were pandemonium, with Hell barking her hardest and two men trying to soothe her. I didn't call her off, because I know she never bites anyone, and I hated the idea of explaining I was in the bath, particularly as I hadn't even a towel to wrap around me. I had blinked my eyes open by then and realized I must have left it somewhere in the kitchen. Mercifully, Heloise quietened down after a minute or so.
"Didn't you hear someone say, 'Come in?'" said one of the men, and I realized that he was an American. It was a pleasant voice, like the nice people in American films, not the gangsters. He called out, "Anyone home?" But the other man told him to be quiet, adding, "I want to look at this place first. It's magnificent."
This voice puzzled me. It didn't sound English, but it didn't sound American either. Yet it certainly had no foreign accent. It was a most unusual voice. Very quiet, and very interesting.
"Do you realize that wall's part of an old castle?" it said.
This was not a happy moment, as I thought he would come to look at the fireplace wall, but just then Thomas came out on the staircase. The men explained that they had turned down our lane by accident and their car was stuck in the mud. They wanted help to get it out.
"Or if we have to leave it there all night, we felt we'd better warn you," said the American voice, "because it's blocking the lane."
Thomas said he would come and have a look, and I heard him getting his boots from the washhouse.
"Wonderful old place you have here," said the unusual voice, and I feared they might ask to look around. But the other man began talking about how stuck the car was, and asking if we had horses to pull it out. And in a minute or so, Thomas went off with them. I heard the door slam, and heaved a sigh of relief. But I did feel a little flat. It was dull to think I had never even seen the men, and never would. I tried to imagine faces to go with the voices, then suddenly realized that the water was cooling, and I had barely begun washing. I got to work at last, but scrub as I might, I couldn't make any impression on my green-dyed arms. I am a thorough washer, and by the time I had finished, my mind was completely off the men. I hopped out and got another can of hot water from the copper, which is close to the fire, and was just settling down to read when I heard the door open again. Someone came into the kitchen, and I was sure it wasn't any of the family. They would have called out to me, or at least made a lot more noise. I could feel someone just standing and staring. After a moment, I couldn't bear it any longer, so I yelled out, "Whoever you are, I warn you, I'm in the bath here." "Good heavens, I do beg your pardon," said the man with a quiet voice. "Were you there when we came in a few minutes ago?" I told him I had been, and asked if the car was still stuck. "They've gone for horses to pull it out," he said, "so I sneaked back to have a look round here. I've never seen anything like this place."
"Just let me get dried, and in my right mind, and I'll show you round," I said. I had mopped my face and neck on the drying sheets and still hadn't taken the cold walk to find the towel. I asked him if he could see it anywhere, but he didn't seem able to, so I knelt in the bath, parted the green sheets and put my head through. He turned back towards me. Seldom have I felt more astonished. He had a black beard. I have never known anyone with a beard, except an old man in the Scotney almshouses, who looks like Santa Claus. This beard wasn't like that. It was trim and pointed, rather Elizabethan. But it was very surprising because his voice had sounded quite young.
"How do you do?" he said, smiling, and I could tell by his tone that he had taken me for a child. He found my towel and started to bring it over, then stopped and said, "There's no need to look so scared. I'll put it down where you can reach it and go right back to the yard." "I'm not scared," I said.
"But you don't look the way you sound." He laughed, but it struck me that it had been a rather rude thing to say, so I added hastily, "There's no need to go, of course. Won't you sit down? I'm sure I've no desire to appear inhospitable." And that struck me as the most pompous speech of my life. I began to put one arm through the sheets for the towel.
"There'll be a catastrophe if you do it that way," he said. "I'll put it round the corner."
As I drew my head in, I saw his hand coming round. I grabbed the towel from it and was just going to ask him to bring my clothes too when the door opened again.
"I've been looking for you everywhere, Simon," said the American voice.
This is the darndest place. I've just seen a spook.
Nonsense, said the bearded man.
Honest, I have. While I was in the lane. I shone my flashlight up at that tower on the hill, and a white figure flitted behind it.
Probably a horse.
Horse, nothing. It was walking upright. But, gosh, maybe I am going crazy. It didn't seem to have any legs.
I guessed Topaz must have kept her black rubber boots on.
Stop talking about it anyway, the bearded man whispered. There's a child in a bath behind those sheets.
I called out for someone to bring my clothes and put an arm round for them.
My God! It's a green child, said the American. What is this place? The House of Usher?
I'm not green all over, I explained. It's just that we've all been dying.
Then maybe it was one of your ghosts I saw, said the American.
The bearded man came over with my clothes.
Don't worry about the ghost, he said. Of course you didn't see one.
I said, well, he easily might, up on the mound, but it was more likely to be my stepmother communing with nature. I was out of the bath by then, with a towel draped around me respectably, so I put my head round to speak to him. It came out much higher than when I had been kneeling in the bath, and he looked most astonished.
You're a larger child than I realized, he said.
As I took the clothes, I caught sight of the other man. He had just the sort of face to go with his voice, a nice, fresh face. The odd thing was that I felt I knew it. I have since decided this was because there are often young men like him in American pictures, not the hero, but the heroine's brother, or men on petrol stations. He caught my eye and said,
hello. Tell me some more about your legless stepmother, and the rest of your family. Have you a sister who plays the harp on horseback or anything?
Just then, Topaz began to play her lute upstairs. She must have slipped in at the front door. The young man began to laugh.
There she is, he said delightedly.
That's not a harp, it's a lute, said the bearded man.
Now that really is amazing. A castle, a lute.
And then Rose came out onto the staircase. She was wearing the dyed green tea gown, which is medieval in shape, with long flowing sleeves. She obviously didn't know that there were strangers in the house, for she called out,
look, Cassandra!
Both men turned towards her, and she stopped dead at the top of the stairs. For once Topaz had her lute in tune, and she was, most appropriately, playing Green Sleeves. Chapter 5. Later. Up on the chaff in the barn again. I had to leave Rose stranded at the top of the stairs because Topaz was ringing the lunch bell. She'd been too busy to cook, so we had cold Brussels sprouts and cold boiled rice. Hardly my favourite food, but splendidly filling. We ate in the drawing room, which has been cleaned within an inch of its life. In spite of a log fire, it was icy in there. I have noticed that rooms which are extra clean feel extra cold. Rose and Topaz are now out searching the hedges for something to put in the big Devon pitchers. Topaz says that if they don't find anything, she will get bare branches and tie something amusing to them. If so, I bet it doesn't amuse me. One would think that a girl who appreciates nudity as Topaz does would let a bare branch stay bare. None of us is admitting that we expect the Cottons to call very soon, but we are all hoping it like mad. For that is who the two men were, of course. The Cottons of Scotney, on their way there for the first time. I can't think why I didn't guess it at once, for I did know that the estate had passed to an American. Old Mr. Cotton's younger son went to the States back in the early 1900s, after some big family row, I believe, and later became an American citizen. Of course, there didn't seem any likelihood of his inheriting Scotney then. But two elder brothers were killed in the war, and the other, with his only son, died about 12 years ago in a car smash. After that, the American son tried to make it up with his father, but the old man wouldn't see him unless he undertook to become English again, which he wouldn't. He died about a year ago. These two young men are his sons. Simon, he is the one with the beard, said last night that he had just persuaded his grandfather to receive him when poor, lonely old Mr. Cotton died, which seems very sad indeed. The younger son's name is Neil, and the reason he sounds so different from his brother is that he was brought up in California, where his father had a ranch,
while Simon lived in Boston and New York with the mother. I gather the parents were divorced. Mrs. Cotton is in London now and is coming down to Scotney soon. Father says Simon's accent is American and that there are as many different accents in America as there are in England. More, in fact. He says that Simon speaks particularly good English, but of an earlier kind than is now fashionable here. Certainly, he has a fascinating voice, though I think I like the younger brother best. It is a pity that Simon is the heir, because Rose thinks the beard is disgusting. But perhaps we can get it off. Am I really admitting that my sister is determined to marry a man she has only seen once and doesn't much like the look of? It is half real and half pretense, and I have an idea that it is a game most girls play when they meet any eligible young men. They just wonder. And if any family ever had need of wondering, it is ours. But only as regards Rose. I have asked myself if I am doing any personal wondering, and in my deepest heart, I am not. I would rather die than marry either of those quite nice men. Nonsense. I'd rather marry both of them than die. But it has come to me, sitting here in the barn, feeling very full of cold rice, that there is something revolting about the way girls' minds so often jump to marriage long before they jump to love. And most of those minds are shut to what marriage really means. Now I come to think of it, I am judging from books mostly, for I don't know any girls except Rose and Topaz. But some characters in books are very real. Jane Austen's are. And I know those five Bennets at the opening of Pride and Prejudice, simply waiting to raven the young men at Netherfield Park, are not giving one thought to the real facts of marriage. I wonder if Rose is. I must certainly try to make her before she gets involved in anything. Fortunately, I am not ignorant in such matters. No stepchild of Topaz's could be. I know all about the facts of life, and I don't think much of them. It was a wonderful moment when Rose stood there at the top of the stairs. It made me think of Beatrix in Esmond. But Beatrix didn't trip over her dress 3 stairs from the bottom and have to clutch at the banisters with a green-dyed hand. But it all turned out for the best because Rose had gone self-conscious when she saw the Cottons. I could tell that by the way she was sailing down, graceful but affected. When she tripped, Neil Cotton dashed forward to help her, and then everyone laughed and started talking at once, so she forgot her self-consciousness. While I was hurrying into my clothes behind the sheets, the Cottons explained who they were. They have only been in England a few days. I wondered how it would feel to be Simon, to be arriving by night for the first time, at a great house like Scotney, knowing it belonged to you. For a second, I seemed to see with his eyes and knew how strange our castle must have looked, suddenly rising from the waterlogged English countryside. I imagined him peering in through the window over the sink, as I bet he did before he came back without his brother. I think I got this picture straight from his mind, because just as it came to me, he said, "I couldn't believe this kitchen was real. It was like looking at a woodcut in some old book of fairy tales." I hope he thought Rose looked like a fairy tale princess. She certainly did, and she was so charming, so easy. She kept laughing her pretty laugh. I thought of how different she had been in her black mood not half an hour before. And that made me remember her wishing on the devil angel. Just then, a queer thing happened. Simon Cotton had seemed about equally fascinated by Rose and the kitchen. He kept turning from one to the other. He had taken out his torch, only he called it a flashlight, to examine the fireplace wall. I was dressed by then, and after he'd shone it up at the stone head, he went to the narrow window that looks onto the moat in the darkest corner of the kitchen. The torch went out, and he turned it to see if the bulb had gone. And that second, it came on again. For an instant, the shadow of his head was thrown on the wall, and owing to the pointed beard, it was exactly like the devil. Rose saw it just as I did and gave a gasp. He turned to her quickly. But just then, Heloise walked through the green sheets and upset a clothes horse, which created a diversion. I helped it on by calling, "Hell! Hell!" and explaining Heloise was sometimes called that for short, which went well, though a worn-out joke to the Mortmain family. But I couldn't forget the shadow. It is nonsense, of course. I never saw anyone with kinder eyes, but Rose is very superstitious. I wonder if the younger brother has any money. He was as nice to Rose as Simon Cotton was, and quite a bit nice to me. There was one dramatic moment when Simon asked me if we owned the castle, and I answered, "No, you do." I hastily added that we had nearly 30 years of our lease to run. "I wonder if leases count if you don't pay the rent." I did not, of course, mention the rent. I felt it might be damping. After we'd all been talking for 20 minutes or so, Topaz came down wearing her old tweed coat and skirt. She rarely wears tweeds, even in the daytime, and never, never in the evening. They make her look dreary, just washed out instead of excitingly white. So I was most astonished, particularly as the door of her room was slightly open and she must have known who had arrived. I have refrained from asking her why she made the worst of herself. Perhaps she thought the tweeds would give our family a county air. We introduced the Cottons, and she talked a little, but seemed very subdued. What was the matter with her last night? After a few minutes, she began to make cocoa. There was no other drink to offer except water. I'd even used the last of the tea for Thomas, and very dusty it was. We never rise to cocoa in the evening, unless it is a special occasion, like someone being ill, or to make up a family row. And I hated to think that Thomas and Stephen seemed likely to miss it. They were still away getting horses from Four Stones to pull the car out. I felt, too, that Father ought to be in on any form of nourishment that was loose in the house, but I knew it was useless to ask him to come and meet strangers. I was afraid that even if he came down for a biscuit, he would hear voices when he got as far as his bedroom and turn back. Suddenly the back door burst open, and in he came. It had started to rain heavily again, and it is quicker to rush across the courtyard than go carefully along the top of the walls. He was freely damning the weather and the fact that his oil stove had begun to smoke, and as he had his rug over his head, he didn't see the Cottons until he was right in the midst of things. Topaz stopped mixing cocoa and said very distinctly and proudly, "This is my husband, James Mortmain." And then a wonderful thing happened. Simon Cotton said, "But oh, this is a miracle. You must be the author of Jacob Wrestling." Father stared at him with a look in his eyes that I can only describe as desperate. At first I thought it was because he had been cornered by strangers. Then he said, "Why, yes," in a curious, tentative way, and I suddenly realized that he was terribly pleased, but not quite believing. I can imagine a shipwrecked man catching sight of a ship, looking like Father did then. Simon Cotton came up and shook hands and introduced his brother, saying, "Neil, you remember Jacob Wrestling?" Neil said, "Yes, of course. He was splendid." By which I knew he thought Jacob Wrestling was the name of a character in the book, instead of meaning Jacob wrestling with the angel, as it really does. Simon began to talk of the book as if he had only just put it down, though I gathered gradually that he'd studied it in college years ago. At first Father was nervous and awkward, standing there with his rug clutched round him, but he got easier and easier until he was doing most of the talking, with Simon just getting in a word occasionally. And at last Father flung the rug off as if it were hampering him and strode over to the table saying, "Coco! Coco!" It might have been the most magnificent drink in the world, which, personally, I think it is. While we drank it, conversation became more general. Father chaffed us about our green hands, and Neil Cotton discovered the dinner dish in the bath and thought it very funny that I'd been sitting on it. All the time, Rose got nicer and nicer, smiling and gentle. She sat by the fire nursing Ab, who is nearly the same colour as her hair, and the Cottons kept wandering over to stroke him. I could see they were fascinated by everything. When Heloise jumped up to sleep on the warm top of the copper, Neil said it was the cutest thing he'd ever seen in his life. I didn't say very much myself. Father and the Cottons did most of the talking, but the Cottons seemed to think everything I did say was amusing. And then, just when everything was going so swimmingly, Simon Cotton asked the one question I had been praying he wouldn't ask. He turned to Father and said, "And when may we expect the successor to Jacob Wrestling?" I knew I ought to create a diversion by upsetting my cocoa, but I did so want it. And while I was struggling with my greed, Father answered, "Never." He didn't say it angrily or bitterly. He just breathed it. And I don't suppose anyone but me saw that he somehow deflated. The carriage of his head changed and his shoulders sagged. But almost before I had taken this in, Simon Cotton said, "There couldn't be."